For those who've not been before, as was said, just a brief summary so far. What I've been trying to explore are the implications of a common human experience, a common conundrum. The experience we have when our eyes see further than our hands can reach, the experience of having ideals which we cannot always fulfill. According to philosopher Carl Jasper, it's the heart of all tragedy, this experience. But whether or not it's taken as tragic, it's certainly a common experience in public life and indeed in private life. To have ideals but be unable to realize them fully and to feel that it matters. What I've also been exploring are some of the characteristic ways of reacting to this experience. One reaction is simply denial, refusing to face reality, still pursuing our ideals blindly to the point of absurdity, pretending reality is other than it is in order to make us feel we've made our ideals work. And the extreme example I gave of this in the first lecture was the soldier turned writer Henry Williamson. So inspired by pacifism as an ideal, he convinced himself that even Hitler could have been persuaded to peace. Another reaction is to end up withdrawing from the field of action, of public action, disillusioned that we have to trim our ideals so much to fit reality. And my example there was left-wing public intellectual Bernard Williams, when he was confronted with the political realities of the 1980s, which made his socialist ideals pretty much impossible to fulfill. I've also been exploring why ideals nonetheless keep pressing, in spite of being thwarted, impossible to fulfill, often, not always, in this limiting world in which we've been set. So last week I suggested it's because the moral impulse which drives these ideals has a unique energy and authority, something which will not reduce just to a cultural or socio-biological explanation, but keeps pressing with a unique kind of compulsion and perfectionism. An impulse, a universal impulse, I was arguing, which even an atheist political philosopher such as Simon Critchley finds so compelling that he can only describe this as a God-like imperative. And I noted, however, how this does sharpen the dilemma, because such an absolute demand and sense of perfectionism will certainly be impossible to fulfill all the time in this sort of world. I also noted that its very perfectionism can provoke another reaction, the temptation, when we inevitably fail, to stress only how hard we tried, and so be rather more concerned with our own integrity than actually pursuing our ideals in some other more constructive way. And I cited as examples here miners in the 1980s, recent government policy on Europe, and Tony Blair's reaction after the invasion of Iraq. What I've also been suggesting, however, is that there is another way of dealing with the conundrum, a way of acknowledging both the persistence and perfection of the moral ideal and the realities which frustrate it without diluting or skewing either, a way of living with compromise but still maintaining motivation and ideals, rather than retreating either to victim status, paralyzing guilt, or just plain fantasy. And this is the way described by American ethicist Stanley Hauerwas, who insisted we can hold on to our ideals fully in our character, in our own deepest dispositions, even when we cannot make them all work in practice, in particular actions. A stance which becomes more possible, I've been arguing throughout, if we can also see those ideals as part of a wider narrative, see them within a worldview of faith in which God, not us, is the ultimate source of those ideals and of their ultimate resolution. A worldview in which we see this frustrating world as an intended theatre of the spirit, forming our character so that some unique virtues are actually arrived at just from the struggle to realize ideals without needing their full achievement just by ourselves. So that's the recapitulation. Now this week, to conclude, I want to turn to another ingredient of the experience of the conundrum. The extraordinary persistence, not just of moral ideals, but also of our sense of purpose in this compromising world. How it is that we do and retain purposefulness, even when our hand so often fails to reach what our eyes can see. And what does that then imply about the nature of the world and of ourselves? To pursue this, I'll first briefly explain what I mean by our sense of purpose, then show just how extraordinarily persistent it is throughout history, even when there's no progress in history. And then, as with a moral impulse last week, I'll suggest what this implies, how naturally this experience of persistent purpose sits within a wider framework of faith. Finally, I'll suggest, again, what sort of personal character and disposition this implies for us, what kind of people we might need to be to sustain such purposefulness realistically. As before, I'll draw on a little philosophy, a little theology, a bit less this week, and literature to do this. Perhaps this week, rather more from literature, as I increasingly think that it's in literature we find human experience most honestly described. Not always true in philosophy, or even, I fear, theology. But first then, what do I mean by this sense of purpose? I mean simply the sense that we're all part of a story with a role to play and a goal to reach, and crucially, the sense that we've not entirely created this story ourselves. The sense that we're in a story and a goal which is partly, at least, given, not just invented by ourselves, individually or collectively. This is the sense, I believe, which is deeply embedded in our culture and our psychology, and not least underlying this common experience of thwarted idealism. Like the moral impulse, it does not depend on any conscious religious allegiance. It appears widely in anyone. It simply appears for many just as part of the grain of reality. There just is this sense of teleology, of purpose, this pull towards a given goal and a purpose of some sort. Now, that definition is obviously not uncontroversial. The alternative, of course, is that our sense of purpose, far from being something objective and given, is something we've just made up to give ourselves meaning in this random, hostile world. That's the view of one of the most vocal critics of any real objective purpose, Richard Dawkins, who thinks, I quote, "We are just inveterate storytellers, inventors. Inventors of meaning, not finders of a meaning that's really there." And of course we are. Of course we are natural inventors. But then I think this actually suggests the opposite to what Dawkins concludes. The instinct, this deep instinct to invent a story and meaning, is actually a response to something really there. Now, why do I say that? Simply because that's the case with most of our other basic human instincts. Our deepest instincts are usually, not always, but usually a sign that there is something really there to satisfy them. We're hungry for food because there is really such a thing as food, whether or not we've got it in front of us. We long for love because there really are such things as satisfying human relationships, whether or not we're enjoying them at the time. The same then with our instinct for a story. We instinctively invent stories about purposes in life because, in fact, in reality, there is a purpose to be found, whether or not we're actually in touch with it. T.S. Eliot's Old Man, in his poem Gerontion, illustrates this, I think, superbly. This old man looks back on his life. He certainly invents a story for it. He looks back on it sentimentally, trying to make sense of it by creating a story, not least to cast himself in a better light, as we all tend to do. And in that sense, his story is just invention, self-deceiving. Think now. History has many cunning passages, contrived corridors. It deceives with whispering ambitions, guides us by vanities. But why does it matter to this old man so much to do this, to create this fantasy about himself? It's because deep down he knows there is actually a real story to be told about him as well, even if it's not the one he's inventing. So as the poem goes on, he has to discover the word within his word. So that's what I mean by a sense of purpose. A core instinct that we are part of an objective story, given, not just invented, as a purpose in life. What I now want to do is also show just how embedded and persistent this is through Western history, not just in our own individual psyche, but how it's so rooted collectively that it persists in some form through huge differences in culture and context through time. So, for example, we could trace it right back in classical philosophy to Aristotle, with his hugely dominating teleological analysis of reality, his view that all things naturally tend towards given ends and goals and purposes. Or we could begin even further back, in classical culture, with Euripides and the Stoics, with their equally dominating sense of overall order, a natural order of justice and cosmic necessity presided over by the gods, to which all things must inevitably conform because it was their purpose, their fate. Then later we see much the same in Spinoza, with his Christianized sense of this overall cosmic order. And later still, there's been this great turn to history, our determination now, well, in the 19th, 20th centuries anyway, to see purpose above all in historical, temporal progress, in the movement to an ever better life in the history of this world, a historicized view of purpose, probably peaked in the 19th century philosophical and theological traditions of Hegel and Marx. So in all these varied and contrasting eras, some sense of a real objective purpose has been there, with or without any explicit appeal to God. What's more, this sense of purpose has persisted even when the supposed supporting evidence of progress has actually crumbled. This is true in both church history and political history, both of which are actually littered with failed doctrines of progress. For the church, the seminal recognition of this goes right back to St. Augustine. In that early patristic age, when God's master plan for the church was thought to be a straight linear sequence of visible success and acceptance, it seemed natural to interpret events like the conversion of the Emperor Constantine and the cessation of martyrdom as evidence that this progress really was happening. But in fact, almost from the beginning, Augustine saw how facile that was and warned against it, rightly so. Constantinianism, where church assumed worldly power, hardly proved an unqualified success. With the subsequent fall of Rome, schism between East and West, the Reformation and Enlightenment, this became even clearer. The church was not evidently progressing in any obvious straight line, but it was fracturing and often declining. The various 19th century European plans of progress for the church simply continued this pattern. No simple linear progress happened. The pressure of events saw to it. Church mission faltered with the rise of pluralism and global consumerism. The doctrine of an inevitably unfolding kingdom of God on earth founded in the horror of the First World War. And then for secular, social, and political history, the same sorts of stories can be told. Social philosopher John Gray is absolutely uncompromising about the failure of all secular programs when they're predicated on an ideology of progress. He cites examples from Marxism to unfettered capitalism to liberal interventionism. Each has eventually failed, even in its own terms, inviting disillusionment. Each has been discredited, not least when it's turned to various forms of instrumental coercion to try and achieve the very progress and success which is constantly being thwarted. So, progress is very ambivalent. And yet, here's the point. A sense of purpose has persisted in both church and political worlds, even when progress has palpably failed in all these ways. The church still keeps trying to embody the kingdom of God, regardless of the dismal lessons of some of its history. Governments keep trying to reform education, health, national security, the environment even, or even the national happiness quotient. These remain as goals, purposes, even when failure keeps subverting all the efforts. That's why we keep trying new paths. We duck and weave. We swing from centralized control to localism, back again, from colonialism to isolationism to liberal interventionism, back again. And even when none of these seems to lastingly produce a narrative of progress, we still pursue our goals as if they're real, as if they're possible. The residual power of purpose is never snuffed out, whatever the empirical reality about progress. And as I said, this really is a personal experience as well as the experience of institutions or nations. Whether we are the sad old man fantasizing at the end of his life in Eliot's Gerontion, or whether we're the visionary teenager following a dream to become a celebrity or to join ISIS, there is this deep instinct in us all to persist with this sense of external purpose, as if we're pursuing something real, whether or not we succeed. And as with the inexorable pull of moral ideals I explored last week, this purpose keeps pulling us forward, regardless of success or regardless of compromise. It's an extraordinary persistence, I suggest, which actually helps confirm, doesn't prove, but it helps confirm that definition I gave of it as something really there to be found, not just an invention of our wishful thinking. And because this is so important, I think, to establish, not least to counter the Dawkins of this world, let me just stress test this even further. Demonstrate that this persisting sense of objective purpose is there even in the places, and this is what I mean by stress test it, even in the places where there's the greatest cynicism about it. Something, incidentally, I find important to try to do, not least to face my own doubts. Doubts I have at those times when the world really does seem to be only random. Because if I can find, even in my doubt, if I can doubt my doubt, this purpose, then surely it's there indeed. So, for example, it can be tested out right there in Dawkins' own mentor, in Darwin himself. His theory of evolution, of course, denies any objective directing purpose in things in its own right. It suggests that the processes of evolution occur, in theory, just by random natural selection, not by any other external directing purpose. But in fact, If you read The Origin of Species and look carefully at the language which Darwin uses, the extraordinary thing is that even here, that work actually breathes purpose through every pore. The apparently random process of evolution is described in a narrative, not just as a sequence of one thing after another, but as a purposive story. A scientific account, yes, but written precisely as a story, as if it has an author, written as Darwin's Plots, the title of a brilliant demonstration of this by literary critic Julian Beer. And Darwin actually admits this at one point in his third edition, the third edition of The Origin of Species. He denies that this necessarily means there is any external hand at work in any sense to work a purpose out through the processes of evolution. He denies that. But he admits that the nature of the processes he's describing have seemed to breathe this story-like quality as if they have purpose, as if they're not just random. I've also had some fun, serious fun, because as I say, this is a way of dealing with doubts in myself, by testing the instinct out in skeptical post-Darwinian literary observers of life, those who write very self-consciously and deliberately as post-Christian, post-metaphysical thinkers. Trawling their writings, some of them, those whose whole assumption is that this is a purposeless world, I find that even here, they find themselves, despite themselves, revealing cracks in this apparently purely random, purposeless reality they believe in. Cracks through which traces of this even deeper sense of purpose do keep seeping in. One good early example, I won't elaborate now for reasons of time, is here in the Abbey, the late 19th century and early 20th century poet and novelist Thomas Hardy. Purpose haunts his work throughout, even though he thinks he's lost it. Well, perhaps to be expected in someone originally formed in childhood in classical and Christian teleology and purpose, just perhaps an afterglow of his childhood beliefs. But then, you see, I also find it in another example, in a genuinely postmodern novelist, someone like Julian Barnes, happily not yet here in the Abbey, I mean happily because he's alive, very happy to have him, should he die, who never had faith in God in the first place in his childhood to lose. Yet even here, his writing still betrays it. And this is where I find the honesty of literature so bracing. Allow me just to give a bit of an example from Barnes's work. It doesn't matter if you haven't read it. I'll try and explain the context. Here first is just an example of how radically purposeless he basically does find the world to be. How random. It's made most explicit in a book called A History of the World in 10.5 chapters, where its whole structure shows the randomness of life. For what he calls a history is, in fact, 10 completely different, or almost completely different, short, separate stories, which, apart from a very few loose thematic connections, a very few, has no obvious overarching link or purpose connecting them. It's summed up in one chapter, a chapter about a 19th century expedition to discover Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat, when one of the characters looks for, I quote, a divine intent, benevolent order, and justice, and all he sees, I quote again, is just chaos, hazard, and malice in the world. And the final summary statement of the narrator, or a narrator, is even starker. I quote again, our current model for the universe is just entropy, which translates at the daily level simply as things fuck up. And that's how he experienced life. It's how he honestly saw it. It's much the same in another novel, when he looks at the history of a personal life, not just the world as a whole. Like Eliot's old man in Gerontion again, he's someone who wants to make sense of a life, but he can't. His honesty won't let him. All he actually sees in his life is, I quote, just a random accumulation of experience. Just unrest. Great unrest. Comes from his little book, The Sense of an Ending. A very bleak view of life. Perhaps one you don't ever experience. But many do. Jesus surely did in Gethsemane. Perhaps, if we're honest, we sometimes do. And that's what I mean by stress testing, going right to the place where it really does seem there is no purpose. But my point is that actually, even here, if you look carefully, there are signs of purpose after all. The very same honesty which has made Julian Barnes face up so radically to the apparent randomness of the world does show him some signs of purpose as well, which he can't avoid out of that same honesty. Even when he's tried to strip his worldview of what he believes to be false religion, false superstition, false ideology, even though battered by the repeated evidence from history and his own life that things simply do not get better and the world is just random, his novels still show signs of purpose. If you look carefully. For example, in that apparently purposeless structure of a history of the world in 10.5 chapters, there is actually an underlying link, after all. Look carefully at the opening story, which is an ironic mimicry of the Noah's Ark story as the beginning of world history, and you find that that is in fact linked to all the other stories by one survivor of the Ark who keeps reappearing, a narrator. It's easy to miss because it's only a woodworm, a parasite, which has survived. But it's there, worming its way through all the different stories, feeding off everything that happens, everything that happens. A hint that perhaps purpose can be found in everything after all. Then in another chapter, actually the half of the 10.5, Barnes suddenly steps out and becomes the narrator himself, interrupts the whole history, and gives this strange but utterly impassioned discourse on love. However meaningless and random things are, he says in this, we must keep believing in the purpose of love. Must? Where does that must come from? It's curious. It's expressed with the force of a metaphysical, not just a psychological necessity. It's as if the force of love we feel is not just one more random thing, but does have objective meaning and purpose, even when events only seem, I quote him, to fuck things up. So again, is this a hint of some objective purpose after all? It echoes, incidentally, a telling moment in a seminar for army officers on motivation, which was held here recently. A serving officer was describing how purpose can and does persist in soldiers, even in extreme circumstances of total chaos on the battlefield. Why? Not, he said, not just, even though even more senior officers were there, not just because of discipline or training, but it was because of love. Love of comrade, even if not of the cause, kept people going with a purpose so real, so compelling, so different. And now I quote him, he could only describe the power of this as a spiritual thing. In short, even in the science of Darwin, the skepticism of literary postmodernism, and for that matter, in the extremities of a battlefield, a sense of objective purpose can still be found, is there to be found. There's always this hidden woodworm of meaning, this purpose of love, this spiritual thing, burrowing behind the scenes. Don't misunderstand me. From time to time, we can all lose it, lose the sense of purpose, lose belief in it, lose the motivation to find it. A form of depression, individual or collective, from which I suspect we can all suffer, and which an honest look at the world surely understands. But the default setting underneath, the underlying reality I've been looking for in all these lectures, is still there. A purpose to be found, even in chaos. Which, now at last, therefore, brings me to its implications. Brings me to what this extraordinary, pervasive sense of purpose might mean about the world and about ourselves, and to a form of argument which I'm sure you'll recognize if you've been here in previous weeks, I've used before. Because having identified an irreducible feature of human experience, first our ideals, then our basic moral impulse, now today our sense of purpose, I simply want to suggest that there must be implications to this. Its personal nature, its persistence, even in the face of a compromising, chaotic, cruel, random world, cries out for a wider explanation. It cries out, if you like, for a wider metaphysic to account for it. And in this case of purpose, that will not be adequately provided. It will not be adequately explained as the ancients did, just as impersonal fate, nor as some scientism does, just as impersonal random mechanisms of evolution. Because neither of those accounts really explain the personal nature of the pull of it, how it always engages personal aspiration, even in a wider cause, which may be more impersonal, and how often it comes to us as the call of love. What will make sense of that is if we see it within a metaphysic of faith, when we see that irrepressible pull of purpose quite simply as the pull of a personal God and his or her purposes, a transcendent God whose pull through this difficult, compromising world persists precisely because it's not a purpose created just by us, but comes from a reality who can fulfill it beyond time and chance. The sense of purpose sits so naturally within that interpretation, especially because of the specific ways the Judeo-Christian tradition has portrayed the divine purpose at work. They match so well this general experience I've been describing. That is, as a purpose which persists without requiring visible progress in a linear way. For God's purpose is in scriptural narrative, just as purpose generally experienced isn't represented ever just as a smooth progression to a final overall fulfillment at the end of the whole process. It's represented in particular moments, achieved through a whole history of ups and downs, in a history of compromise and failure. Think of the history of Israel, God's promises to them fulfilled within 4,000 years so far, of devastating ups and downs, wilderness wanderings, exile, homecoming, diaspora, near genocide, back to homeland again, but who knows what next. Likewise, with the 2,000-year history of the Christian church, a similar pattern, just as Augustine foresaw. Yes, first a great expansion of Christian faith in the ancient world, but then divisions. These retreats in the Industrial Revolution, at least in Europe. Yes, growth bubbling up again elsewhere in the world, but who knows what next? It's within and through all those crosses, resurrections, crosses again, not through smooth linear progress, that God's purpose consistently calls and is fulfilled through the particular struggles of faith and love and hope forged on the way, efforts of faith and love held in eternity, but not necessarily always reaching visible fulfillment in history. And it's this same biblical pattern which makes so much sense of our secular histories too, not just religious history. Seeing it in that way, as the pull of God's transcendent purpose. It's the pattern that can make sense of all continuing private and political and public efforts, whether for good personal relationships or for social justice. Even though we may well get to the end of our personal life or political life and not see the outcome we hoped for at some linear end point. It's when they're seen as part of a divine purpose which can give them eternal value in themselves that they can gain a credibility and a meaning and a sense that simply cannot be provided by any utopian dream, any secular ideology that requires their value to depend on some successful end point in time. Put simply, it means that if you or I or some political program end up in time in tatters, which actually, of course, we all do, that doesn't ultimately matter. All that was good and worthwhile in particular moments on the way still has meaning as part of that wider divine purpose in time and eternity within this faith perspective. And so here, finally, we're seeing how practically transforming this worldview can be, in particular by being so supremely motivating. To believe that particular action can have this depth of meaning and purpose in this way, in itself, even when in the linear passage of time it's being thwarted or compromised, can keep us motivated in frustrating times as nothing else can. Its motivating power is visible in human relationships whenever we see people instinctively engage in individual acts of generosity with other people, including strangers, without needing to see that action validated by some visible long-term outcome. It can be seen in other contexts too. In that army seminar, for example, again, we were told that on the battlefield, soldiers must be able to find their motivation by seeing value in particular shorter-term goals, even perhaps especially when the wider strategic success is in doubt. Or in a political context, it's important to be able to see the worthwhileness, for example, of full democratic rights and freedoms in our particular context, and be willing to defend them and be motivated to do so without needing to see that value depending on their long-term success universally, everywhere else as well, at some end point of history. Surely an important lesson for the West to learn in geopolitics, where too often our sense of moral purposiveness has depended on feeling we have to see it and enforce it beyond our own context, universally. And the point is, it's the perspective of faith which helps us in this. For sub specie tenitatis, we never have to justify the purpose of a particular project solely by reference to an overall final success that we must see in time. So it is, we've come indeed to see the sort of people we might need to be within the sort of worldview, to a metaphysic of the soul to match this metaphysic of the world. That is to say, we shall be people whose deepest disposition is to keep acting purposefully in particular situations without needing visible success, without also feeling we have to make everything successful by coercion. People, therefore, with enduring hope and motivation in everything, yet always yoked with humility, realism, respect for what has to be left outside our remit, left to God working through others in time and eternity. As before, Dag Hammarskjöld, former Secretary General of the United Nations, serves as my exemplar of this disposition. And so again, I'm going to leave you with his words. It was at a gathering of the press corps of the General Assembly on April the 9th, 1958, after he'd been struggling with monumental successes and setbacks in Suez, in China, in the wider Middle East, that he said, very often I ask myself, have we made progress? And to that, he said he could not answer clearly, because he did not subscribe, I quote again, to the facile faith of generations before who thought everything was developing towards progress. But he was able to say this, the future will be all right if there are always certain kinds of people. That is, people with profound faith in a wider purpose, but with no pretensions to be the only ones who can and must make it all happen. People instead, as he said elsewhere, who are always prepared to be only a means and not an end. For these, as I've been arguing throughout, are perhaps the kind of people who can still live purposefully even when idealism is frustrated, who, when the eyes see further than the hands can reach, will not retreat either to fantasy or coercion or cynicism, but still be pressed by their ideals, able to sustain a realistic pursuit of them. It's been the aim of all these lectures, simply to show that to be this kind of person, to have this sort of disposition in our character, in public and private life, is perhaps not only desirable, but actually also credible within this wider worldview of faith. Thank you for your attention.